Welcome to Medically Speaking, Auburn's own medical radio show with host Dr. Mark Vaughn of the Auburn Medical Group and Larry Finney.
Welcome to Medically Speaking Radio. This is Dr. Mark Vaughn.
And I am Larry Finney.
We are so glad to have you with us. This week's show, we are going to dedicate to the new mammography recommendations by the United States Preventive Services Task Force.
And our guest is Dr. Michael Antonini.
Of his surgical group at Sutter Auburn Faith Hospital. Do you remember the name of his surgical group?
Yeah, I couldn't hope to remember it.
Yeah, we had to ask him when we interviewed him. Actually, it's a pre-recorded interview. We like to make you think that it's happening live, but this week we'll just come out and say it.
No, we're not really here.
It's not a live show.
So. We're off doing something else.
Yeah, but we're glad you're listening to us. And next week we will be live, and we'll be speaking with Dr. Joshua Hampman, who will be speaking about healthcare reform. And we're going to have people calling in. It might get a little bit interesting.
Well, it's kind of an interesting thing about being live. We're only live once, and then this becomes a podcast, and then it's not live anymore.
But every time, we're actually doing it right when we're doing it.
Yeah. Well, we're doing it right now. There's a sort of a zen here. Oh, well.
What's coming up?
Well, let's see. Looks like we have a Celebration Cares All-Star Concert benefiting the Family Birth Center at Sutter Auburn Faith Hospital. That will be on Monday, December 14th, 7 o'clock p.m. at The Ridge. That's the famous golf course at 2020 Golf Course Road in Auburn.
And they have a lot of people. And this time, let's actually read through the list of all those musicians and singers.
Well, we have Luann Lee.
We have Cedric Lee.
Now, he was a bass player.
He played with Michael McDonald.
And Larry Carlton. We have Arthur Thompson, drummer for Toby Keith, and the late, great Wayman Tisdale. We have Jeff Tamalier, a guitar player for Tower of Power, a great all-time funk band. We have Grant Reeves.
Tower of Power. Didn't they do the horns on some Genesis and Phil Collins?
I think they may have. They did a lot of studio work. Grant Reeves, who is a saxophonist for the Neville Brothers, or actually he opened for the Neville Brothers. And Aaron Gaydon, who is a vocalist with Maranatha.
Now, you said a name there that sounded familiar, Tisdale?
Wayman Tisdale, former Oklahoma, let's see, was the University of Oklahoma?
Isn't there also a vocalist named Ashley Tisdale?
And he played for the Sacramento Kings. Yeah, I don't know about Ashley Tisdale, but...
Okay.
But this Wayman Tisdale was the Kings player, too. Anyway, the tickets general admission tickets are $10, reserve seats are $20, and if you really want to contribute, VIP seats are $85, which includes a dinner at 5:45 and VIP seating. So for more information, please contact the Celebration Community Fellowship at 530-878-1365 or on the web at www.ccfellowship.org.
And as always, if you need that information and you didn't catch it, you can find it at medicallyspeakingradio.com. This week, happened.
We are saddened to hear the passing of one of Auburn's medical pioneers, Dr. Gordon Seck. He passed away peacefully at home the day after Thanksgiving following a brief illness. And he was nearly 80 years old.
Yeah. And our listeners will remember that he was actually one of the old Auburn doctors that we had on that show that we did from the Placer County or Gold Country Medical History Museum.
Right. We kind of had a reunion tour of some of Auburn's pioneer doctors. Dr. Seck was one of them. And I suppose it's safe to say that one of the last recorded interviews with Dr. Seck was that show.
If not the last, yeah.
It was August 15th of this year. And those who want to remember him can go to our site and find that particular show. What was the title of it?
I think it's Placer County Medical History.
Yeah.
And it was the August 15th show. So you can still hear his voice on that. We wanted to go over some things about the breast cancer screening, the mammography recommendations before our interview with Dr. Antonini.
Things to keep in mind.
One of them is the very recommendations we're talking about are specifically for people who don't have a family history of breast cancer, people who have not had radiation to the chest.
And these recommendations, of course, are the new recommendations put out by the, I never remember the name of
United States Preventive Services Task Force,
right,
a body under the NIH that comes up with standardized recommendations for screening for disease.
And this is the group that brought forth these new guidelines that made news has been making news now for quite some time, basically saying that in contravention or I should say in contrast to the conventional wisdom heretofore followed, that women should get mammograms starting at age 40. This task force came out and said starting at age 50 and only every other year.
Yeah. And one thing that I need to read it, because I know in the interview it doesn't come out real clearly. And even Dr. Antonini said that he wanted it to be clear that this is not saying don't get a mammogram at age 40. Here's the exact wording of the recommendation from the United States Department of Health and Human Services. The United States Preventive Services Task Force recommends against routine screening mammography in women aged 40 to 49 years. The decision to start regular biennial screening mammography before the age of 50 years should be an individual one. And I'll say that again. Even though they're making these recommendations, the decision is an individual one. I continue on the quote. And take patient context into account, including the patient's values regarding specific benefits and harms. So we want to make sure that it doesn't sound like an absolute statement that must be followed. It isn't written that strongly.
Right. Besides, we're talking to the good people of the Foothill area who do what they want to do, right? They're not going to be, by God, told by the federal government that they can't have a mammogram before the age of 50.
No, and that's not what they're going to do. Other things coming up, we talked about Celebration. Is it called Celebration Cares? Anyways, we talked about the concert. And this Christmas, I believe plans are that we're actually going to have a live show the day after Christmas talking about hospice and bereavement and grief. And so kind of an awkward thing to do in the Christmas season, but but there are so many people that it's that very time of year that hits them so hard. And so this show is especially going to be dedicated to those people, people who may not be with a whole lot of family having a joyous celebration at Christmas, that this show may be exactly what they need. So we want people to be aware of that.
So I was wondering, Dr. Vaughn, right here in the greater Auburn area where you practice, what are you seeing in terms of H1N1?
Well, we're seeing a whole lot of it. And now it's actually seeming to trail off, which fits with the national numbers that we've been seeing, that it's going from being widespread in all the states, and over the last few weeks it's been getting more sporadically spread out throughout their states. I have been getting the H1N1 shot out to patients, and we still have some for our patients. Our understanding is that a lot of H1N1 stock is going to be delivered very shortly to the whole country, so that those people who are really needing are going to get it. We've been doing our best to get our supply to the county and to people who really need it, like pregnant patients and young children.
So the vaccines appear to be working in terms of prevention?
Yeah, it looks like it's helping out. Yeah. I don't know if it's necessarily because the vaccine got out there and that's why we're seeing it go from widespread to not as widespread. I would think that it is because we're getting into colder time of the year, and you'd actually expect to see the numbers continuing to rise. So to see it go down a little bit.
Now, is your vaccine needle or is it the nasal?
We actually have both. We have a very small supply of the nasal for the little kids because it's been found to work better in 9 and under. And, you know, it's a lot easier to give it than a shot to a kid.
Do you ever get screaming kids in there, the kind that just absolutely don't want to be?
We don't get them under age 5, so no. We don't get a whole lot. I think we had one that cried last week. I heard about it.
Well, crying, but I mean, it's the kind you have to hold. Because when I was a kid, you had to tie me up and hold me down.
That's why it's nice to have that nasal. Also, I was noticing on the numbers for Placer County, they were able to get 8,600 children vaccinated in the county through their H1N1 vaccination program.
And did those individual kids have to pay for this or out of their pocket?
No. The administration of it is covered, I believe, through the county, and the shot itself is owned by the federal government. We're going to take a break now and listen to our wonderful musical disclaimer. And then after that's done, go into the commercial break.
The content of this website and the Medically Speaking radio show are meant for entertainment and for general information purposes.
No doctor-patient relationship is attempted or implied through the show or the website.
Any medical advice, home remedies, and all other medical information on this website or radio show should not be treated as a substitute for the medical advice of your own doctor.
Do not attempt any treatment mentioned on the website or the show without consulting your doctor.
Always consult your own doctor if you are in any way concerned about your health.
If you need a doctor and live near Placer County, call Jen at 530-886-8630.
If you have a medical emergency, call 911.
Medically Speaking Radio, Dr. Mark Vaughn, Auburn Medical Group, K-High Radio, and or our sponsors are not responsible for any diagnosis or treatment made by anyone based on any of the content of this website or the Medically Speaking Radio show.
In addition, the views and opinions expressed on the show or on linked websites are not necessarily those of Dr. Mark Vaughn,
K-High Radio, the Auburn Medical Group Incorporated, or any of the show sponsors.
Since 1966, Sutter Auburn Faith Hospital has been providing award-winning care to members of the community, to people just like you. The tradition of excellence continues today with our comprehensive family birth center, cancer services, 24-hour emergency care, and a whole range of outpatient services with convenient hours and locations to serve you.
In addition, we've been recognized for excellence in managing heart attacks, heart failure, pneumonia, and surgical care. We are one of a select few hospitals in the state to earn recognition from VHA's West Coast region for sustained outstanding clinical performance.
To learn more about Sutter Auburn Faith Hospital, visit us on the web at sutterauburnfaith.org/medicallyspeakingradio. That's sutterauburnfaith.org/medicallyspeakingradio.
Sutter Health, with you for life.
Larry, have you ever been to Auburn Drug Company?
Yeah, that's the one with the marble soda fountain at 815 Lincoln Way.
Yeah, right there in front they have the marble fountain, and in back is an independently owned pharmacy right here in Auburn.
And that thing has been around for a long time.
Since the 1800s. They are so great because they actually fill your prescriptions when you ask them to, unlike the chain drug stores that make you wait.
You know, and waiting there wouldn't be a big crime because, heck, you could always go to the soda fountain.
That's Auburn Drug Company at 815 Lincoln Way in downtown Auburn. Give them a call at 885-6524.
Now, back to Medically Speaking with Dr. Mark Vaughn and Larry Finney.
Okay, welcome back from the break. This is Dr. Mark Vaughn on Medically Speaking Radio, and this week we are talking to Dr. Michael Antonini of the surgical group right here at Sutter Auburn Faith Hospital. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
First of all, since we've not had you on the show before, can you introduce yourself to us as far as where you went to medical school, residency, training, and experience up to this point in your career?
Sure. I've been practicing general surgery since...
been a long time, huh?
Yeah, been a long time. Actually, 11 years, roughly. Practiced for 4 years, a little over 4 years in Southern California, and then moved up here. I've been practicing in this community as part of Sierra Foothills General Surgical Specialists for a little over 5 years. Trained in Wisconsin Medical School, Medical College of Wisconsin, and did my residency in Pontiac, Michigan at a community hospital. And my first job was in Southern California. My wife and I packed up the truck and moved to Southern California.
Never back to the Midwest since.
Well, only to visit family.
Okay.
And preferably when it's warm.
Medical College of Wisconsin, did you ever run into John Ma in emergency medicine?
I did not.
Okay. That was neither here nor there. What we're talking about is the changes in the mammography recommendations that came out from the United States Preventive Forces Task Force, a body that is under the NIH that comes up with recommendations. They are not the exclusive body that comes up with recommendations for screening for cancer. They are one of several. Another one would include the American Cancer Society, American Academy of Family Physicians, American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, and there are probably others that I'm not remembering, who also come up with their own recommendations based on reviewing the literature, studies that have been done, testing as best they can, different ways of screening for breast cancer and treating it.
Yeah, but it's this U.S. Preventative Services Task Force that recently dropped a bomb on the news the other day.
They certainly did.
Changing the recommendation for how the frequency of screening mammographies or mammograms.
They made a few definite recommendations. I'm going to go through the list here and actually enumerate them. They recommend against the routine screening by mammography of women aged 40 to 49 years. They say the decision to start regular biennial, meaning every other year, screening mammography before the age of 50 years should be an individual one and take patient context into account, including the patient's values regarding specific benefits and harms. Okay, that's one of them. That's for mammography in the age 40 to 50. They're saying don't do it there.
And for context, what was the former recommendation?
The prior, now I actually don't know if it was to do it annually or biannually from them.
But it started at 40.
Right. And American Cancer Society, it still remains to do it annually. And then they recommend biennial screening mammography for women aged 50 to 74 years. They concluded that the current evidence is insufficient to assess the additional benefits and harms of screening mammography in women 75 and older, so they're not recommending it. They recommend against teaching breast self-examination. They don't recommend against doing it. They recommend against teaching how to do it. They concluded that the current evidence is insufficient to assess the additional benefits and harms of clinical breast examination, meaning when the doctor does it in the office, beyond screening mammography in women 40 years or older. So they're not even really hip on doctors doing a physical exam for checking for breast cancer. And then they conclude that the current evidence is insufficient to assess the additional benefits and harms of either digital mammography or magnetic resonance imaging instead of film mammography as screening modalities for breast cancer, saying just use the plain old X-ray mammogram instead of these fancy new technologies.
Now, this sudden departure from the old way has set people off, set tongues a-twittering about what could possibly be behind this. What's the motivation?
Yeah, and I don't know this body, and I don't know who is on it, where they're coming from, where they're going, who they have relationships with. I'm trusting, and I trust that it is a body that reviews the literature and looks at it and says, you know, it really looks like we're not going to lose much by making these changes. Now, some would argue with that, and the concern is, are we going to actually lose lives because of it?
Well, I think their argument is that you're exposing women to more risk by either false positives and therefore the risk of unnecessary surgeries. Is that the drill?
That's exactly it. The other side of it is, and Dr. Antonini will be able to help me more with this, they're espousing this idea that we're over-diagnosing. And by over-diagnosing, they have a definition for that, and that is picking up cancer that we would never otherwise be clinically aware of. That's what they call over-diagnosing. So it could be there. It could be present in a patient's breast. But if in their entire lifetime you never even know it's there, then you're going too far to find that out because it does nothing for her clinically.
So we're saying it's possible to have a small amount of cancer and not have it be harmful.
That's the question. Since we've been picking up cancer earlier and earlier and earlier, and if we see what we call ductal carcinoma in situ, which is so small, it hasn't even broken through what's called the basement membrane to invade, am I getting this right, Dr.?
That's correct.
To invade into anything below what's like skin. It's actually inside the duct, but it's like the surface of skin, except yeah, different part of the body. So it's not invading into the body at all. Well, we've been taking it all out as soon as we see it. We're just not inclined to leave it to see what its natural course would be. We're not going to do the Tuskegee trial here again, this time on breast cancer patients. So we don't know. It may be that half the time that's discovered, it never would have done a thing.
Well, and we're not talking about, we're talking about people here. I guess as a layperson, folks out there probably think, we're not talking about cars. You know, if my car starts burning oil, I'm not going to immediately run out and get a ring job. Maybe I'll just, you know, let it burn oil for a little while, and then when it finally goes too far, then I'll get a ring job. It'll cost no more to get it done then.
Right.
And I can let it go a while. But you know, when we're talking about cancer, I don't think people are as eager to say, ah, let's just ignore it for a while.
Yeah. Do you have any knowledge of studies that have shown that letting DCIS go can go for a while before it causes problems, or it can go until it's clinically evident and you don't lose anything?
I think it's as you said, that there may be a very high percentage of them that don't progress to a frank breast cancer. So it's not something that I think we understand fully at this point. And as with many parts of this argument, there are many aspects of it that we don't understand. So I think there's a lot yet that needs to be studied and discovered.
Yeah. Yeah. These new recommendations, thinking in terms of your own wife, sister, or mother, what would your advice be to them on getting, in age 40 to 50, getting mammogram or bionomammogram with your knowledge of breast cancer and these studies we're talking about?
I was hoping you wouldn't ask that, because my wife is going to be 40, not in the near future, but upcoming. Mm-hmm. I would have to leave that to her, to her and her sense of what she feels is right for her.
Yeah.
She, in her particular instance, family history is not an issue, so I would. But she's very cautious, so I think that she would probably lean towards that 40-year mark for the initial mammogram. And hopefully then as things mature, maybe the interval can be spaced a little bit wider than 1 year. It's a difficult question, and it's particularly after we talked initially looking this up, there's a mortality risk in the people aged 40 to 49, and so there has been a proven benefit, and that's in this...
Mortality from the cancer.
From screening.
So there's benefit to catch it.
Yes, there is a reduction in mortality in screening those aged 40 to 49, and it's on this website, U.S. Preventative Task Service's website. So it's difficult really to understand exactly what this recommendation is when it seems to be looking into the previous recommendation. It seems to be consistent with the previous recommendations as well, as far as the statistics, not the blanks, not the statement that says now we recommend that mammograms start at age 50. The information as far as mortality seems to be consistent with the 2002 recommendations. So again, it's very hard to understand
how they can come up with this.
Yes.
So I think what's going on here is they're saying that they're accepting that there will be someone who will die by following the change in recommendations. And so you can say, how do you ever justify that? And I guess the way they're justifying it is by saying that there are so many people who won't have to get the inconvenience of biopsies, the anxiety associated with, do I have cancer because my mammogram came back positive? I guess they're making some kind of an equation where they're saying X number of people going through this stress and this risk of biopsies equals someone dying from cancer.
Yeah, that's exactly true. And it says that in here, in those terms, that is their metric, that they use this harms versus benefit, i.e. Okay. mortality benefit to screening.
Did you happen to see any kind of number with that? I've been looking for it, and I haven't found that.
As far as how they...
How many people they say,
Yeah, it's about one in 2,000.
Okay.
You need to screen about 2,000 women aged 40 to 49 to detect, to save one life.
I do have that number. I think I have what you're talking about. The number needed to invite for screening to extend one woman's life.
Yes.
1,900... And 4 for women aged 40 to 49 years.
Yes.
And 1,339 for women aged 50 to 59 years. 1,300 versus 1,900 is not that far apart, really.
That's correct.
But they're drawing a line there somewhere saying that's worth it. Now, they're not saying, I wish I had different data to look at here, because I'm used to seeing this more in terms of years of life that you're saving or losing, rather than, how was it worded, extend one woman's life. Right, so they're going to keep one person from dying, age 40 to 49, for every nearly 2,000 who get screened. It's not saying anything about how many false positives they're expecting to have, how many people are getting biopsies, Certainly it's not any more than 1900. We know that. Do you happen to know off the top of your head false positive rates for
I don't have the number. It's roughly 10% as far as...
10%. Most of the news we've been getting, though, has been a war of sound bites. And there was an article that came out earlier this week. It quotes a fellow by the name of Daniel Coppins. He's a professor of radiology at Harvard Med School. He says that deaths from breast cancer have dropped by 30% since 1990, when mammography screening beginning at age 40 became more widespread. Now, he's in favor of screening at 40. So he's saying... Deaths have dropped by 30% since 1990, when mammography screening beginning at age 40 became more widespread. But what the article doesn't get into or discuss is treatment. You know, is the drop in deaths strictly from the screening, or is it from something else? Is it treatment and surgeries?
I think that's manipulated to a certain extent.
Yeah. I mean, he throws the...
Is this someone who makes money off of mammograms?
Well, you know, interestingly, I had to look him up. The article simply identifies him as professor of radiology at Harvard. But if you look up his bio on the web, he's also the director of breast imaging at Massachusetts, easy for me to say, General. Yeah. So, he's got... Well, I'll say it. He's got some skin in the game.
All right.
No pun intended.
Okay. We do need to take a break here. When we come back, we'll continue discussing this question of changes in mammography recommendations.
Do you find yourself overspending, overeating, or in unhealthy relationships? Is your anger out of control, or do you struggle with drugs and alcohol? Are you tired of just trying harder to deal with your struggles? If you answered yes to any of these questions, there's help available. Celebrate Recovery is an international ministry that meets locally at Parkside Church, 3885 Richardson Drive, Auburn. Meetings are held every Friday night from 6 to 9:15 p.m. All areas of recovery are welcome. Celebrate Recovery is a Christ-centered, 12-step recovery program that offers real and lasting change. Contact Sheila Dobbin at 823-9911. That's 823-9911. For a listing of Celebrate Recovery locations, go to celebraterecovery.com. We invite you to join us at Parkside as we celebrate recovery.
This is Dr. Mark Vaughn. I wanted to let you know a little bit about our practice at the Auburn Medical Group. The physician, nurses, and front desk personnel all approach the patient, asking themselves the question, how would I want to be treated if I was in the patient's shoes? Listen to what one of our patients has to say about her experience at the Auburn Medical Group.
My name is Susie Brown. I just want to sincerely thank that group of people for being there for me in some emergency situations. They are very efficient. Their staff, including their receptionist, even when you call her, she's got sympathy and compassion for you. And when you're ill, that's what you need. The nurse staff is wonderful, and Dr. Vaughn listens to everything you say, and they just get on things. They do not let anything lag.
If you need a doctor, call us at 886-8630 or look at our website at auburnmedicalgroup.com.
Gritstone Rock Club is Auburn's premier climbing and fitness facility. They offer rock climbing instruction for climbers of all ages and ability levels. In addition to classes, Gritstone Rock Club hosts birthday parties, has a team-building ropes course, and provides professional outdoor instruction. If you want to climb with Gritstone Rock Club, contact them at 530-885-ROCK or online at gritstonerockclub.com.
Now, back to Medically Speaking with Dr. Mark Vaughn and Larry Finney.
Welcome back from the break. This is Dr. Mark Vaughn and Larry Finney of Medically Speaking Radio right here on KHI AM 950, your voice of the foothills. We've been talking with Dr. Michael Antonini of Sierra Foothills
Surgical Specialists.
I never get people's business names correctly. And we've been talking about changes in mammography recommendations from one particular body and possible reasoning for that and possible implications of that, good or bad. Your group... Surgical. Please say it again for me.
Sierra Foothills Surgical Specialists, yes. Incorporated.
There are four surgeons.
That's correct.
Dr. Bradshaw, Dr. Jenkins, who's been on our show in the past, Dr. Antonini, yourself, yes. And your new doctor is?
Dr. David Skihan.
Skihan, okay. And you're all general surgeons?
We are all general surgeons, that's correct.
And all perform breast surgery? And
we perform breast surgery among, a broad scope of general surgery, including colon surgery, gallbladder surgery, hernia surgery.
And the American College of Surgeons gave Sutter Auburn Faith Hospital a particular designation in regards to cancer surgery. What was that?
We owe thanks to Dr. Bradshaw and people that helped him with that designation. And it's escaping me right now, unfortunately. I think we're official cancer center.
Yes. Okay. What I wanted to do is walk through the experience of a patient who would be dealing with exactly what we're talking about here. They have their mammogram, their doctor counsels with them, which is what we're currently doing in our practice instead of just automatically ordering them like we used to before these recommendations came out. We are actually having a bit more of a dialogue about the pluses and minuses. And so I'll sit down with them and say, you know, if you're concerned about over-testing and having complications from a test that never had to be done, you may want to think twice about getting a mammogram. Other people who want to do everything to prevent having cancer, and that's more the concern, then I will recommend they go ahead and get the mammogram like we used to get. These recommendations at this point don't tie anybody's hands to a particular type of practice. And so when they get the mammogram, if they happen to be in that about 10% that has a false positive, there'll probably be some re-imaging. They'll go back and have different views or have an ultrasound done. And then at that point, if it still hasn't cleared up, if it looks like something's there, we'll ask them either to have a stereotactic breast biopsy, which means they go to a radiology center and under guidance of the imaging device, whether it be a CAT scan, an MRI, or an ultrasound, it localizes where the finding is in their breast that we're concerned about, and somebody puts a needle in there and pulls the cells out for analysis. That's one way they can have a biopsy. Another way is to go see somebody like Dr. Antonini. And what happens at that point?
At that point, typically, we will direct the patient according to exam to a certain extent and to their preference. I think in most cases, because of mammography, things are discovered fairly early. So these abnormalities are not palpable, meaning we cannot pick them up by exam.
By touching the breast.
By touching the breast.
Seeing what the tissue feels like.
That's correct. So in that instance, we cannot do a surgical biopsy unless there's something in place to guide us to that area of question. Most of us will direct a patient, if possible, to a stereotactic biopsy. And those are done, as you said, sometimes with MRI, sometimes with ultrasound, sometimes with a mammogram. There are special devices that do stereotactic biopsies. And that, I think, again, is our preference. But I list it as an option for the patient, as one of the options. The other option is a surgical biopsy. Again, this is for an abnormality that's not palpable, meaning we weren't able to feel it with our fingertips. We could do something called a localized biopsy. And in that case, what we have to do is we have to have the radiologist get involved in this situation as well. But they will put a marker, typically a wire, down in the area of this abnormality. We then proceed to the operating room and follow this wire, which has what we call a thick part. Sometimes there's a dye that's injected around this part of the wire. And once we get to that part, we will remove some of the tissue in that area. I think you can imagine it's kind of imprecise. It's meant to establish the diagnosis.
So this wire is a tracing device?
It's a guide.
Okay.
But that in that instance, it's not typically meant as therapy. That's meant to get some tissue to establish a diagnosis. And I think to make that clear to patients that they may end up requiring a second surgical procedure to for the therapeutic part of their visit to the surgeon.
What kind of results can come from this biopsy?
There are several different pathologies. I mean, as you mentioned, DCIS is probably one of the more common things we'll see with the small lesions that are discovered by a mammogram. Breast cancer, the infiltrating ductal cancers are the more common breast cancers that we see. There are lobular cancers, invasive and non-invasive. There are radial scar is sometimes what you'll see. Oftentimes we'll see not malignant or not cancerous growths, or but we consider them to a certain extent to be a marker of a risk for malignancy down the road. These are atypical ductal hyperplasia, those types of things. So there are abnormal cells that are seen under the microscope. They're not, frankly, cancerous. They're not exhibiting cancer-like behaviors. And those are this is probably the not completely inclusive list, but those are the most common things we'll see.
I've always had a question about the cellular atypia. If something showed up on a mammogram and you do a biopsy of it and you find cellular atypia, my thinking is there is no way that cellular atypia would grow to something big enough that you'd see it on mammogram, or am I wrong?
I think that most of us believe that if left alone for a long time, that in many cases those will progress to an invasive cancer, but that's a progression that takes many years. It's not something that would take place in weeks or months. I believe that it can.
So supposing you do find those, that they're non-cancerous, but they're, I can't remember what you called them.
The atypia?
Yeah, atypia. What do you do? Just leave them alone? Or?
I think in most cases of atypia, atypia that's been diagnosed by a lesser invasive method, either that needle type or the guided biopsy that the surgeon would do, or a stereotactic type biopsy. The situations where there may be atypia, or in situations where there may be atypia, we worry that there are these other diseases in the ballpark, whether a frank invasive cancer or whether there's ductal carcinoma in situ, this non-invasive form of cancer. Obviously, these in today's medical community, those require other treatments. For example, in the case of ductal carcinoma in situ, that woman would have a consultation with the radiation oncologist to talk about radiation therapy, to sterilize the breast or potentially kill any remaining cancer cells, and also have a consultation with a medical oncologist to talk about hormonal manipulation or means to potentially modify their risk for developing a breast cancer down the road.
Okay. The treatments that you're describing can also lead all the way to further surgical treatments.
That's correct. If there is a diagnosis of ductal carcinoma in situ and specimens or tissue is inspected for what we call margins. So we remove part of the breast, whether it's stereotactic or a formal surgical biopsy. You want to, with some degree of confidence, say that you've removed all of that disease. And if the stereotactic reports ductal carcinoma in situ, if your surgical specimen reports ductal carcinoma in situ at the edge of what you've removed without an acceptable margin of normal tissue, then that may trigger another surgical procedure. If there's a cancer there, then there are other things that would be considered. There's still a margin consideration, but in that instance, we talk to patients about looking at their lymph nodes to see if breast cancer has traveled from the breast to the lymph nodes.
All right.
Well, what are typical outcomes? This stuff, also, I'm certain, sounds pretty scary to patients or potential patients. More often than not, is there a happy ending?
That depends on how you define happy. I think for most part, breast surgery is very well tolerated. The majority of breast surgery, I think, in our group amounts to what we call lumpectomy and the sentinel node biopsy. So a woman would end up with a scar on her breast, and that's to remove the either the ductal carcinoma in situ or the breast cancer. Typically, scars on breasts heal very nicely cosmetically. They're not deforming usually. And then the axillary or the lymph node part of the surgery generally is very well tolerated.
That's the armpit.
Yes. We look in the armpit for lymph nodes, see if their breast cancer again has traveled from the breast to the lymph nodes, and that's a marker of potential marker of disease elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So that too is not therapy. I think that's one way to look at, you know, is there a happy ending? I think it's very well tolerated. We can operate on quite old, you know, quite elderly people because again it's well tolerated. Both emotionally, I think, you know, being a man, it's hard to say categorically that it's emotionally well tolerated. It's my sense that it's very well tolerated both emotionally and physically. At level of activity is not impaired significantly by breast surgery. Obviously, if you have a young woman with metastatic disease, the outcome, the happy ending is in question. So, there's a broad category there that you could talk about. With the small burden of disease, people should do very well. With a large burden of disease, you don't expect that they do well. I think that's the easiest way to look at it.
How about recovery? What's the patient looking at in terms of recovery time?
I think
return to normal activity.
Sure. I think from breast surgery itself, it's relatively short, within a matter of a few weeks. If they undergo the lumpectomy, again removing a small portion of the breast and looking at the lymph and the sentinel node biopsy or even the axillary node dissection, I think it's relatively limited recovery, meaning a 2 or 3 weeks, with return to activities 85-90% of normal, maybe even better, depending on the degree of surgery. Then there's 6 months or so of chemotherapy, and I'm sure everybody has friends or family that have gone through that and know the toll that chemotherapy takes. Some women tolerate it very, very well and barely bat an eye. Some women become ill during chemotherapy, and that's, I think, not something that as a surgeon I can predict well. I think the medical oncologist would do a better job of maybe making some estimates as to how well a woman would tolerate the various regimens or the dosages that are given.
Okay. We're going to take a break here. This is Dr. Mark Vaughn and Larry Finney speaking with Dr. Antonini, and we will be back after this break.
This is Dr. Mark Vaughn. I want to tell you about my dentist, Rodney Kihara. His office is located right in town at High Street and Auburn Folsom Road. His staff is pleasant. They smile when you walk in, and you know who they are because they're there every time. We're talking about Flo, Cheryl, and Judy. Their pleasant faces welcome you into the office and let you know that you're in the right spot, a comfortable place to go to the dentist. Call Dr. Kihara's office at 888-1966. That's 888-1966.
Few things in life are harder than thinking about serious illness or the death of someone you love. Research confirms that Americans want the basic services that hospice provides: care at home or in a home-like setting, treatment that preserves a sense of dignity and respect, emotional and spiritual support for patients and for their families, and effective pain management. Hospice helps patients and their families deal with end-of-life challenges in a life-affirming, compassionate way that brings dignity, hope, and love to every day of life. This message of love and caring is the focus of hospice care. This message is brought to you by Sutter Auburn Faith Hospice. We can be reached at 886-6650 or click on the link for Sutter Auburn Faith Hospice on the Medically Speaking Radio website.
The doctor would say, don't stick anything in your ear. Unless, of course, it's Medically Speaking. On K-High, the voice of the foothills. Now, back to Medically Speaking with Dr. Mark Vaughn and Larry Finney.
Welcome back from the break. This is Medically Speaking Radio with Dr. Mark Vaughn and Larry Finney. We're speaking with Dr. Antonini here at Sutter Auburn Faith Hospital.
Oh, yeah. Well, you see, literally at Sutter Auburn Faith Hospital.
Actually in the tele unit, or what used to be the tele unit. Anyways,
yeah, you might want to explain why that's it. But all the slamming doors.
You can hear nurses needing to get from the intensive care unit back to the medical floor, and that's... I think we're going to hear it again here in a second.
That's okay.
No, she's just walking by.
It's called ambiance.
I think I made a face at her, and she turned around. speaking about not just mammography, but also breast cancer treatment in general is kind of what the conversation's involving. And during the break, we were discussing how could they come up with anything that would say, don't get a mammogram that could save someone's life. And the reason has to do with all the biopsies that are done. And one thing that a question we have is, of the biopsies you do for suspicious breast lesions, approximately how many of them, what percentage, turn out to be cancer?
I think the statistics are a little bit old as far as I can remember. Of the mammograms that were done, again, this dates back to residency days, we would do biopsies in about 20% of them. And I'm sorry, those numbers are not correct. We would do, of the lesions or the abnormalities that were felt to be that were felt to require a biopsy, only about 20% of them were lesions, if you will, that needed to be pursued with more therapies.
So 1 in 5, 4 out of 5,
correct,
turned out to be a nothing.
That's correct.
Okay, so that's what we're talking about there. What we didn't get from the numbers that they gave, you know, they said that 1,900 women would have to be screened to extend one woman's life or save one woman's life, ages 40 to 49. They don't say how many of those had to go on to get the biopsy. So that's kind of a tough thing. We don't have the full numbers to know, to advise patients on this. We know that about 1,900 have to be get a mammogram for one life to be saved. We know that of the ones that have to go on to get a biopsy, about 4 out of 5, that's where it ends. One of them has to go on and do further.
Right.
And then we have to, after they've had a positive biopsy, if it didn't require treatment because it was just hasn't broken through the basement membrane, or it's I guess we'll call it little cancer, caught early, what kind of follow-up do the patients then need to have?
So just to be clear, we're not talking about a cancer here. We're not talking about ductal carcinoma in situ. We're talking about that 80% that didn't need any...
No, the say if it is one of the 20% that had to have an actual lumpectomy.
Okay.
And it was just restricted there, say, ductal carcinoma in situ.
Okay.
What follow-up would they have?
We would send them to, initially, the initial follow-up would require a visit with a radiation oncologist to talk about whether or not radiation therapy is indicated, and also a medical oncologist to talk about, again, risk reduction with tamoxifen or the hormone manipulators. From a surgical perspective, we would follow that patient in the office. They would get mammograms over, you know, various intervals. Initially, meaning after a biopsy, they would get a mammogram in about 6-month interval. A biopsy, as I think would be apparent, would change the architecture of the breast. You need to reestablish a baseline. So again, you're talking about a 6-month interval mammogram. And then yearly after that, as indicated by exam, as indicated by other features. But roughly 6-month follow-up mammogram after the biopsy, and then you're back on your yearly schedule.
Okay. Has there been conversation in your circles about these changed recommendations?
In our group or...
In your group or among other surgeons you have contact with?
I haven't had social conversations in that regard, no.
Oh, okay.
Probably a lot better things to talk about socially. Yeah. But yeah. We're just wondering how you felt about the, you know, are you of the thought that early detection is best?
Well, of course, well, absolutely.
Yeah, obviously,
yes.
But is this way too early? I guess it's really the question.
Yeah.
If
is there such thing as too early?
If 4 out of 5 turn out to be nothing, then are we putting people through a lot of angst for for no good reason.
Yeah, and that's what it comes down to, is where do you draw a line?
At 2000 to 1?
Yeah, well,
at considerable cost.
Yeah. Yeah, I have not seen calculations as far as how much money is being spent to save the one life. If you're saying 1,900 mammograms to save one life, do you know what a mammogram costs? I don't. I'm guessing a couple hundred dollars.
Well, I'm not thinking about the cost to save the one life. I'm thinking about the individual patient who is one of the 80 percenters who is going through a lot of medical intervention, not without cost, for ultimately no reason other than maybe peace of mind. And I'm not so sure that the peace of mind is assured after going through all that.
That's a good point.
Yeah, that is a good point. If you have a false positive, you don't feel real good.
Yeah, right. You're not loving it.
Right. Yeah, that's the thing that this is coming from. And there are differing opinions on it. American Cancer Society very much disagrees and is saying, no, we want it every year, and this is saving lives. And they're right. It does save lives. But it is something that I want my patients to talk about with me if they have a question about it. I want patients who aren't my patients to talk to their doctor about it. About, you know, is it what they want to do?
And to be fair, I think the new guidelines aren't saying don't have it done more early. If you want to have it done more early, have it done more early. But the fear, the underlying fear is, will the insurance companies now use that, these new guidelines, as an excuse to not pay for early?
It's a possibility.
Yes, I agree. And I think that kind of it puts the onus on us to a certain extent to do a better job of history taking. It puts the onus on patients to a certain extent to pay more attention to their family histories.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Dr. Antini, we thank you for being on our show. We're glad to have you. We've now had two of the members of your group on the show, and we'd love to have the other two as topics come up. And you guys can call us if something comes up. We'd love to have you.
It's important, if I may. The U.S. Services Preventative Services Task Force wasn't created to, you know, be an affront to patients. It's there actually to help. And one of their mission statements is that they were created to create some equality. To create some equality amongst the population.
Trying to come up with standards.
Standards, exactly. So. And I think, again, one of its mission statements, and I'm not a member, I'm not here to defend them necessarily, but it certainly is concerning when you have very vocal people out. There are very vocal people out there that have access to media that have denounced this, and maybe rightly so, but I think that, you know, we need to keep our minds open so that science can advance. I mean, this is not, we don't know everything about breast cancer, and that's one of the exciting things about breast cancer science today. There's a lot that's being developed. Breast cancer for one woman is not the same as it is in another woman. There's a lot of different biology out there, and this organization was created to help, you know, make sure that there was some equality out there as far as who has access to care and the quality of that care.
Yeah, and in fairness to them, I guess I really should point out that even though we are emphasizing that strict adherence to the new allowance or recommendation would result in a loss of life, which we don't want to have, it would be not nearly as much as you would think. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because breast cancer, when it's discovered, when somebody realizes, hey, there's something there that's not right, and gets it checked by the doctor, oftentimes it's caught in time to treat it. And people who would claim that their life was saved by a mammogram, because that's what picked up their cancer, oftentimes, if they never had the mammogram, and then the cancer was evident, and they discovered it themselves, oftentimes they still would have been fine. And so people that are calling into the radio shows and saying, I'm in my 40s and it was discovered on mammogram, and I'm here today because of that, that's not necessarily true. But at the same time, I don't want my family member to be the one that they find it out on. So it's a bit of an unknown there. Again, we thank you for being on the show and the time you took to be here. And we want our listeners to beware. We'll be back next week with another great show. Those who are listening on the podcast, we encourage them to go ahead and rate the podcast wherever you get it from. That helps us to get more listeners out there in internet land, and all those people who are looking for medical information on the interweb. And Larry, you have any last minute thoughts there?
Well, no, other than, you know, we apologize for the slamming doors and
that's right. Don't call in to the tech or the
yellow Trevor.
That's right, the operator of the studio. Okay, this is Dr. Mark Vaughn, Dr. Antonini, and Larry Finney telling you to stay in good health.